This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney.
We need to nail down commitments relative to jobs that will be generated by this. We need to nail down commitments with respect to return on investment.
Hamilton County Commissioner Todd Portune, the debate over a soccer-only stadium for FC Cincinnati continues. But first, Richard Cordray says he'll step down as head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Is he entering the Ohio governor's race? Joining me now, WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson and Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles. Joe, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
And Howard, good to see you.
Good to be here.
Joe, what do we know at this point? How likely does the fact that he stepped down from the CFPB make it that he's going to run for governor?
Well, everyone seems to think it makes it pretty likely, and especially when you look at his opponents, his potential opponents on the Democratic side, they were responding to his stepping down as if they thought he would be entering the race. And of course, we've been hearing from the Republicans for a while now about Richard Cordray, because I think they thought a long time ago that he would be entering the race. This certainly, the timing of this works so that he could get in the race. He could raise money quickly, and he could be in for the primary. So it looks very likely.
I don't think there's any question that that's what's going to happen, that he's going to enter the race. He's going to probably enter by my birthday, which is December 6th. And, he's going to join this field. And it was amazing, and I'm sure you noticed this too, Joe, that, you know, as soon as he had told his staff that he was leaving the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, it was almost immediately that some of the other candidates, Democratic candidates for governor, started firing off press releases being very critical of him.
Very critical. Okay.
Very critical of him, saying he was basically abandoning his post and leaving this important agency that helps consumers to Donald Trump and the Republicans in Congress, and they were going to destroy it. And they went straight after him.
Is he getting in too late? Do you think this is?
Well, no. Or, I mean, it's always.
They've been doing
this. You know, the other candidates who are actively campaigning. We were four of them, and they've been doing this for months and months, and trying to raise money and traveling around the states, and they've even held some. Debates that have been sponsored by the Ohio Democratic Party. They're trying to get their names out there and get known, and he hasn't been able to do that in his job in Washington. But he is a figure who has served as Ohio Attorney General, served as state treasurer. There's probably some residual name recognition left from that. Although he hasn't been on the ballot in Ohio since 2010, and 7 years is a long time in politics. But, he's obviously going to be a serious candidate.
Why does he have to step down from the Bureau? Is there something that requires him he can't run for a state office if he's holding a federal position?
Absolutely. It's called the Hatch Act, and it prohibits most federal employees from doing anything in terms of partisan politics, whether running for office or working for candidates or anything. Hatch Act prohibits it. So he has had to be very quiet about this and not talk about politics in public and not respond to the many questions that reporters and others have asked him about whether or not he was going to run for governor. He just has to say no comment.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Joe, how would Cordray's entry, how would it change the dynamics of the race? How do you see it affecting it?
You know, Cordray has much more name recognition than the other four candidates in the race, statewide name recognition. Plus, he's held statewide office. He's been the treasurer. He's been the attorney general. He has a lot of experience working in issues involving ordinary consumers, average Ohioans, working people, those kind of things, especially with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. His work there was to protect consumers from egregious things that might have been done in the financial industry. So he has a platform that he can run on. He has the name recognition and the experience, And as Howard said, you know, he really he doesn't need the type of the long time period that all of the others need to raise money. He can go out and in a good weekend, he can get, you know, the money he needs to be in this primary. And he shouldn't have any problem raising it, you know, his connections in Washington and elsewhere. He shouldn't have any problem raising enough money to wage a good campaign in the fall.
I've got a column running at WVXU.org on Sunday about Cordray. And one of the points I'm making in that column is that one of the things that he will probably bring into this race is not only, like Joe said, the ability to raise money very quickly, but probably get some very high-profile endorsements from people like President Obama, or Bernie Sanders, or certainly an Elizabeth Warren, who has been a very big supporter of that bureau. And, you know, they're going to come out and endorse him and probably campaign for him in Ohio for governor.
And one of the things to note here is Cordray could have the potential to appeal to the very same voters that Donald Trump appealed to when he ran for office. He, you know, like I said, he comes off with that working man. Here's how this affects you, and I'm going to be the champion for you kind of narrative. If he has that on the campaign trail, he could very easily get some of those people that were attracted to the message that President Trump had on the campaign trail when he campaigned.
That's exactly right. You know, I think his campaign message is basically, hi, I'm Rich Cordray. I spent the last 6 years retrieving $12 billion for regular folks like you who were ripped off by payday lenders and unscrupulous
financial institutions. And he had the same reputation when he was Ohio's Attorney General, right?
Yeah. But, I mean, this was his job in Washington as the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, was to go after these payday lenders and some other in financial institutions who were taking advantage of people. And he collected $12 billion for consumers. And that's a really good message to go out and campaign on and say, hey,
that's,
you know,
his elevator speech right there, Howard.
Absolutely.
Howard just wrote it for him.
Absolutely. I mean, it's easy. No, it's an easy one.
So, Joe, I guess at this point, the next move is up to Richard Cordray.
Yeah, I think Howard's right. The next move is right. And Howard, you know, was talking about December 6th. I think it will be soon. You know, Rich Cordray is going to be out of this position by the end of the month. So anytime after he's out of this position, he could announce. And so I think, you know, the deadline to formally file and get in there is February, but he's definitely not going to wait that late. So I think We're all waiting to see when it is.
He doesn't have to do it on my birthday. So he could do it, you know, like if he leaves at the end of the month, I mean, he could walk out of the office and hold a press conference in Columbus and say, I'm a candidate for governor.
Joe, meantime, what is the latest on the allegations of sexual harassment and misconduct in the Ohio legislature? Because there have been some things going on this week.
Oh, yeah. We've had a representative, a Republican representative, who resigned after inappropriate behavior in his office. He apologized, and his resignation was accepted by the head of the Ohio House of Representatives. That representative was a freshman, a Republican, Wes Goodman. He was from up in the Morrow County area. But he wasn't the only one that was ousted this week, or that left this week, I should say. The chief of staff for the Senate Democratic Caucus, Mike Primo, also resigned. And that was also due to inappropriate behavior. But because he apparently told, you know, whatever happened, it was said to an attorney. So now there's some questions about attorney-client privilege, and we don't really know what Mike Primo exactly did that caused the resignation. But certainly those two resignations this week have come on the back of other problems that we've seen. Republican Senator Cliff Hite, about 3 weeks ago or 2 weeks ago, he resigned after there were some problems with him sexually harassing. He admitted and apologized that he had, engaged in conduct that with a woman that was not not becoming of someone in his office, and there were allegations that he was threatening her with her job, sort of by being out there doing some of the things he was doing. There were some others that have come to light, but not nearly as significantly. And right now, as I'm speaking with you, we have a talker here where a sitting Supreme Court Justice, Bill O'Neill, who had said he was going to run as a Democrat for governor, he's actually made a Facebook post, and people on both the Democrat and Republican side are calling for his ouster after this Facebook post that is quite It's bizarre, quite frankly.
It is.
It's kind of like, hey, everyone's paying attention to Al Franken over here and all these problems with sexual harassment and all these things in the closet. So let me tell you mine. And he goes on to divulge some personal information about himself and some of his, sexual past or whatever. And he says, he's doing that because he thinks it's ridiculous the amount of attention that's being paid to that. And he said he wasn't going to run for governor, but this Facebook post certainly makes it sound like he is. So
yeah,
he said if Cordray jumped in, he wouldn't run. And
right.
Now that it looks like Cordray's jumping in, you'd think he would kind of, not do this, but hey, there's nothing in journalism school that prepares you for this kind of thing.
So. No, it just seems to keep going and going as well. It seems like something new every other day. So
yeah, and that's an O'Neill thing. It's going to take him out, I think. I mean,
I think so.
Whether, it takes him out from the Ohio Supreme Court, it certainly takes him out of any consideration for governor, no matter what Rich Cordray does. He has told David Pepper that he was not going to run if Richard Cordray does, and you have to take him at his word for that. But if this blows up the way it's blown up over the last few hours, his career is in deep trouble.
Joe and Howard, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles and WVXU Politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. We'll continue our weekly news review, what's going on with plans for a stadium for FC Cincinnati. You can join us, 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. FC Cincinnati is bidding for one of two Major League Soccer expansion franchises. In the meantime, the back and forth over a permanent stadium for the team continues. Here to talk about it, WCPO.com government and political reporter Amanda Seitz, and from WVXU, reporter and digital news editor Tana Weingartner, and reporter and local host of All Things Considered, Bill Reinhardt. You can join us, 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Good afternoon, Amanda. Thank you for being here, and same to you, Bill and Tana. Thanks for being here this
You're
afternoon.
Welcome. Yeah, thanks
Happy
for having
to be
us.
Here.
So where do we start with this whole thing? I guess you have to go back to Tuesday.
Well, let's even go back further than that. Last Thursday, Jeff Birding and FC Cincinnati had a press conference in their office and said, well, here's our latest proposal. We would like the county, the city, to use hotel tax revenues to help us build the stadium. We're looking at Oakley. We're still looking at the West End, and we're looking at Newport, but Oakley is what we're really kind of looking at. We're trying to close on some options on a couple of parcels there. And then,
actually, what they said was they wanted help with the infrastructure around it. They offered on Thursday to build the stadium but with private financing if the city and county would allow the extra stuff around it.
Okay. So in other words, they'll pay for the stadium if the city does things like what? Parking garage, roads, and facilities around the stadium.
Right. They're talking about $75 million here. So there has to be a little more than roads, a parking garage, and some sewers. And what those specifics are really is unknown still.
Right.
It could include something like land acquisition. It could include something like site readiness. We don't really know.
Well, and then you're saying they're asking to tap into the 2.8 million that's generated each year or that's left over. I'm always confused by that whole thing.
Well, this year it was 2.8 million that was left over from the hotel tax. Right, but it changes every year. I think you wrote about this, right, Amanda?
Yeah, so the hotel tax is super complicated, first of all. One, we already have the highest in the state, pretty much. The city collects 4%, the county collects 6.5%. So if you're in the city of Cincinnati and you get a hotel, you're paying 10.5%. That money mostly goes to pay for the maintenance of the convention centers, both Sharonville, Duke Energy, and it also pays for the bonds that were taken out a couple years ago to do a huge upgrade of it. There's been a couple of million dollars on some occasion left over, but as recently as 2013, there was only a $1 million left over from that pot used to do economic development, visitor type things.
Now, Bill, you said let's start back on Thursday.
Last week.
What comes then? What comes next? What's the next in this?
Well, then on Tuesday, the FC Cincinnati said, "Okay, we've got a new plan here. We will pay for the entire stadium. It's going to be a little bit smaller. Now we want you to help the county and the city to help us with the infrastructure." Wednesday, county commission met. They reviewed that new proposal and said, "Okay, we'd like to help. We will help, but we really want you to look at Paul Brown Stadium." And at that point, you could hear every soccer fan in Hamilton County's head explode. The whole hang-up on that is Major League Soccer says, "We want you to have a
soccer-specific only,
stadium
right.
built." Yeah. FC Cincinnati has said, "Look, we can't use Paul Brown Stadium because of revenue sharing and all that. We need to take all the money at the gate so we can pay our players." And Todd Portune and Hamilton County Commissioner said, "No, let's sit down and talk about this. We really want you to use Paul Brown Stadium because it's empty most of the year. We're already paying for it. Why build another stadium somewhere?" So then with that, Todd Portune says, "Okay, that's our plan A. Our plan B is, yeah, if that doesn't work out, if we sit down and talk about it and you still say no, then yes, we will help you with infrastructure."
Okay, and Amanda, you're saying this amounts to $75 million. The county's going to pay for part of that and the city would pay for the other part of it. Can the city do that? That's the question.
Yeah, so the county's offered $15 million approximately. That's what they estimate the parking garage will be. They've done a lot of parking garages, so they have a good handle on what that'll cost. I talked to city council members this week. I talked to Vice Mayor David Mann yesterday, who said, "I don't know where we'd go from here. I don't know how we make up $60 million. And I think they were kind of counting on the county to come through, and that was a risky bet because the county already owns two stadiums. They've been very clear that they don't want to own a third. I don't think at any point they came across like, yeah, we really want to help kick in this $100 million. So there's a huge question mark as to where we go from here. The mayor said he was going to hold a press conference this afternoon. That's looking more and more unlikely as the day goes on that will happen.
And mostly we should say because he's been in Columbus all day at a mayor's meeting thing. So we just don't know if the timing might work out on that. Not that something might be backsliding necessarily, or it could be. Who knows?
I would guess that he spent most of the day trying to hammer out a deal, too. And who knows if he's gotten to one.
He may have a deal and just not have a press conference, but release the deal and let everybody think about it over the weekend. So we may see may see a proposal and just not a press conference, which
But the question is, even if he comes out with something, does he have enough votes on council
to get it? Exactly. And that's why I'd be curious to see if he holds a press conference today, because does he have the support? He doesn't want to be the only one standing out there in front of City Hall announcing a plan for the FC Cincinnati Stadium.
Now, Amanda, I've heard in the past talk about using like a tax increment finance district to help pay for this. What's that whole idea about?
So basically what that does is any new development that would be built around the stadium when it becomes constructed, the property taxes on that new development would be funneled back to pay for the construction of that stadium. So the city puts up a loan or backs the loan with the idea of this TIF. They use the property values, the increased property values that they get, the taxes from that, and funnel it back to help pay for the construction. Now, that seems to be – everyone seems to kind of be on board at the city level with doing something like that. But that's only going to generate a couple million dollars. That's not going to get you to your 60.
Yeah. The question I wonder is, last week there was discussion about the Port Authority getting involved. Has anyone heard about if they're out of this mix altogether?
That's a huge – another unknown in this is who will own this, right? It seems like FC Cincinnati doesn't really want to actually have ownership of it, that they would like a third party. They've said that a couple of times. Again, city and county aren't necessarily raising their hand too quickly on this, and we haven't heard from the Port Authority much.
Now, Bill, you mentioned that that FC Cincinnati came back with some scale-back plans, since they're saying they'll pay for the structure itself. What are they talking? I think the original plan had been build something that's 25,000 seats in size. And
yeah, now it's closer to 2021 with possibility of expansion. They were originally talking about a 4,000 space parking garage. Now they're saying, we could do with 1,000.
1,000, okay. Tana, as far as Oakley goes, I mean, why the attraction to Oakley? What do they see there that they feel like that would be a good spot?
Because you don't have to buy multiple parcels of land in order to get enough space to build your stadium. There are several that would be large enough. The one that they have kind of identified, there's a source at Oakley that has told several media outlets at the community council that the site, which is sort of kind of behind Kroger there, where 71 and
near
everything
the movie theater,
right?
Too.
Yeah, it's grown
it's near
up
Mantry,
so much,
isn't it? Kind of in the same area as
near Mantry and Crossroads, yeah. And all of that, where all that growth
where
has
the
happened.
Mess is already. The mess is.
Right. So, but you get, you know, you make one purchase and you get enough land for a stadium.
Okay. What does FC Cincinnati have a plan B, Bill? Do they, if all this falls apart, if they said this is what we would do,
FC
plan
Newport.
B would be Kentucky.
Plan B would be Kentucky.
They say they are still talking to Newport about locating along that stretch right next to the Licking River where it meets the Ohio River. There's been a planned development there, mixed-use development, for years and years and years, and nothing has happened. I think that's called the Ovation.
Right.
And, I mean, it's been talked about so long, the billboard advertising it has just faded away to nothing. And they say, yeah, this is still a viable solution for us. And if we can't get a deal done in Hamilton County, we will go across the river to Kentucky.
The question, though, is do they have time to go over to Newport? And we're talking about a matter of days that FC Cincinnati says that they have to get their application in. And I'd question if they have enough time to go over and strike that deal with Newport. And that could be why they're applying so much pressure right now to the city and the county.
Mm-hmm. When is the announcement coming on? Do we know a date on when MLS is going to decide which two teams are going to be the new expansion teams?
The announcement's on the 14th, but the application is due on the 4th. So really, you have to get all this passed in a couple days. You've got the Thanksgiving holiday. City Council, I believe, is canceled next week. That doesn't leave too much time.
I'll defer. Those dates don't sound quite right to me, but that's okay.
They've changed. We've heard a couple different.
So much. Yeah.
We happened to double check this morning with FC Cincinnati because we had our own confusion on the dates.
Yeah.
So that's the latest that we heard from them this morning.
Does the fact that FC Cincinnati doesn't have the stadium plan in place yet, how much does that hurt them with MLS? I mean, is that a big deal? Could it be a deal killer?
That it's not done now?
That's not done now, yeah.
No, I think you just have to have your plan by the time they want to hand them out.
Yeah,
I mean, it's not helping.
Right.
Not helpful at all.
Right.
We took a look at where all the possible MLS teams stand. And really, we found that we were kind of surprised. We found that a lot are kind of dead, to be honest. So St. Louis, Indianapolis have been named as applicants. Those deals are pretty much dead. There's been no movement on a stadium there. And it seems like there's really three cities left, and that's Nashville and Sacramento, both of which have their deals done, ready to go. And then there's Cincinnati that has this big question mark. It seems like it has a really good chance of getting into the MLS, but the stadium is a huge hang-up for them. Detroit's been talked about too, but the MLS seemed to really rebuff the idea of using Ford Field where the football team plays and not allowing them in because of that.
Mm-hmm. Bill, when you were go ahead, Tanner.
Well, I was just going to jump in because you had an interesting article, Amanda, earlier this week about looking at all of those teams. And what I thought was really interesting in that was, you know, you were saying, well, how much is everybody there paying and all these different things, which I find interesting. We're looking at a stadium here that's now $200 million. You know, they've wanted $250 million stadium. And then, you know, 75 is the estimate to fix all the infrastructure around it. But when you were talking about, like, in Nashville and all these other places, way lower numbers and teams paying for all of it. So I would like you to talk a little bit about that article.
Yeah. So the Sacramento one, we found that they did do the infrastructure. They did about $46 million for an overall site, though. They're doing a huge redo of their downtown. So they have been for years building up this site in Sacramento. But the stadium was privately financed. In Nashville, it's such a complicated deal. But essentially, the team's going to pay back most of what the city has borrowed to build the stadium, which I believe was $200 million as well. But what was interesting to Tana's point is a lot of cities have dropped out simply because they don't want to have any involvement with publicly financing these stadiums. That's why we saw Indianapolis, St. Louis. There were a couple of others, too. There was a Phoenix, they're privately financing their stadium. So it seems like for a lot of these cities, the hangup is really the public financing.
Mm-hmm. The public financing. Could you make the argument that what FC Cincinnati has offered, privately financing the stadium itself and then the public funding dropping? Because I think it was originally $100 million, and now you're talking $70 to $75 million. Could you make the argument that, that's a pretty good deal?
I wouldn't say that it's really dropped all that much. If you take a look at the numbers a little more closely, first of all, up front, the investment was going to be they were asking for $100 million. So you're maybe talking about a $25 million savings. What a lot of people are asking is, why is there $75 million in infrastructure cost? Because a lot of public officials assumed when they were asking for a $200 million stadium from the onset that included the infrastructure costs. So to suddenly say, oh, we need this extra $75 million for the infrastructure cost kind of calls into question what was the cost all along for the stadium, really. Mm-hmm. I was actually given some documents earlier this week that showed infrastructure costs at $18 million in some initial projections. So again, it kind of calls into question what was the cost of the stadium all along, really.
Has anybody heard any reaction from people who live in Oakley to the thought of having a soccer stadium in Oakley?
I know the community council said they were on board. They met with FC Cincinnati last week and said, yeah, we're all for this. I saw a tweet. I wasn't able to follow up on it earlier that said, yeah, not everybody in Oakley is happy about this. Also seeing on Twitter, I've seen a lot of fans say, yeah, we don't want it in Oakley. We'd rather have Newport. Or I've seen people insist that the West End is the best place.
So is that West End site still in play? Is that thought of it out there? Or is it just pretty much Oakley and Newport now?
The only mention of that I've seen is a couple of fans saying the West End is the best place.
So where does this go next? What happens next?
Well, we see, I guess, what the mayor has to say.
Yeah.
Or not have to say. And then I think it's just a bunch of backdoor bargaining and dealing and wheeling and dealing.
So we're going to see this back and forth going on. Yeah.
That's also what's been so fascinating is from the onset, you know, the city and the county said that they really want to do this out in the public. There's going to be a lot of public vetting. We really haven't seen much of that up until this week, really. There has been a lot of backroom dealing on this. And it's kind of a different course than what public officials said that they would take from the beginning.
Tana, you had a story earlier this week, too, that Dayton Dynamo Football Club. I wanted to ask you about that, too, while we had you on, because as long as we're talking about soccer developments, this is kind of an interesting development, isn't it? This was the team that was originally the Cincinnati Saints, right?
Yeah, so started as the Cincinnati Saints by a guy named Dave Satterwhite. And frankly, his whole grassroots movement, he's the one that sort of envisioned having professional soccer in Cincinnati. But as
so
we know,
he led
really
us to FC
expensive.
Cincinnati.
Well, some people might say that it's a lot of money to get to Major League Soccer. So he kind of got big-footed by the Lindner family, if I'm just going to say what a lot of people have said. And so they went to Dayton and were in the NPSL there, the National Premier Soccer League. And then they just announced this week that he's found a new majority owner for the team. It's Jared Davis, I think. He's the founder of a company up in Dayton and vice president of it now. And they're going to make the jump to the professional leagues. There'll be a league that's sanctioned by USSF, the United Soccer Foundation. Federation. And so we don't know what that means. Like, does that mean USL? Does that mean whatever comes of the current NASL league, which is sort of in turmoil? But they're going to go make a professional go of it. So should
I guess
be interesting.
They're going to be in search of a stadium now themselves.
Oh, no. Right. So then now you have a whole stadium thing going on in Dayton, right? Which is interesting because they just did that deal with Chaminade Julia and they've been playing at Roger Glass Stadium, which they kind of did in conjunction with them. So I don't know. Good for Dayton.
And how long before they make the move? I mean, is it going to happen right away?
Yeah, so they're not going to play in 2018.
Okay, so nothing
next year. They're going to take off and play in 2019. But you're talking about hiring a full-time staff and paying your players a professional wage, not just, hey, we happen to make some extra money at the gate, so everybody gets a per diem today.
And Amanda, I want to ask you, too, about another story you did at WCPO.com, back to FC Cincinnati. What about FC owners contributing to local politicians? That was an interesting article.
Yeah, so we were kind of curious because it was so quiet on the city side. What was going on, you know, that we could look at over the last couple months with FC Cincinnati owners and specifically city council and the mayor's race, but we also took a look at the county commissioners as well. And we found that Mayor John Cranley got significant donations over the last couple months from FC Cincinnati owners. We included the owners themselves, and then we also caught a lot of donations that were made on the very same day from multiple family members, so spouses, siblings, parents in some cases, children. And we found that about $53,000 went to Mayor Cranley. Interestingly enough, not a penny to his challenger, Yvette Simpson, who had kind of really laid down a tough line about the idea of paying for an FC Cincinnati stadium. She said that if any incentives were offered, for example, that she would want a living wage to be paid to all of the people that work there of $15 an hour. So she was, you know, not going to just hand over a nice gift to FC Cincinnati if she became mayor.
Bill and Tana, any final thoughts on the stadium?
Not on the stadium, but there was also some news coming out of Hamilton County Commission on Wednesday. And they're all very, very proud of it.
Okay. I earned some brownie points here.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Well, Wednesday, before the meeting started, all the media outlets had representatives there. The commissioners came out and said, oh, you're here for the MSD sewer raid, aren't you? Crickets. But commissioners did hold sewer rates steady for the next year. They haven't passed a budget, operating, or capital for the next year. But for the third year, they are going to – people who have Metropolitan Sewer District – they're not going to pay any more. They're not going to pay any less.
In sewer rates.
In sewer
your
rates.
Water rate might go up. So your bill may change.
Tana,
to
you're
be
very
clear.
Wise. It's split into two parts.
Yeah. Your bill might go up, but not
the
your
sewer
rate part of it.
Yay. Well, thanks everybody for joining us this afternoon.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.
WCPU.com, government and political reporter Amanda Seitz, and from WVXU, reporter and digital news editor Tana Weingartner, and reporter and local host of All Things Considered, Bill Reinhardt. Coming up, Nelson Peltz wins the recount in his proxy battle with Procter & Gamble. What's next? This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Last month, Procter & Gamble declared victory in its proxy fight with activist investor Nelson Peltz, but not so fast. A recount now shows Peltz has won a seat on P&G's board. And here to give us the details and what happens next, WCPO.com business reporter Dan Monk. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Dan, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
To see you.
You too.
What were the results of the recount? What happened here?
Well, go back to the day, a few days after the annual meeting. First of all, at the annual meeting, P&G said we won the election. A few days later, they said the margin of victory was about 6 million votes. And then the company that they hired to actually count the votes, the Inspector of Elections, a company from Delaware called IVS Associates, completed their count.
And that's all these kind of companies do, isn't it? Is they audit proxy votes.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah. And so when they actually counted all of the votes, it turned out that Peltz won by 43,000 votes. That was his margin of victory. And if you think about that, out of 2.67 billion shares, 43,000, it's a margin of 0.00. It's, let's see, 0.0019%.
You figured it out.
That's how razor thin the margin is. Yeah.
It's interesting because 43,000 – that could have been one investor because, as I understand it, you get one vote for each share you own. So that could very well have just been one person or a handful of people.
That's correct. It could have easily been one person, yeah.
Now, and it's also interesting too, Dan, because when we talked about this earlier, you said that Peltz had said during the first count back in October that he thought he had a huge lead. I think he thought he had like a 175 million vote lead at that point.
Yeah. When the annual meeting started, when they actually at 9:03 that morning – he said his count was that they were up 175 million, and there were, I think, a total of 200 million shares that he didn't know the answer to, and he found it hard to believe that P&G won all of those votes or a vast majority of those votes. So he was immediately not willing to accept P&G's conclusion, and that's kind of what's confusing here. Is I thought the votes were counted. How did it end up differently? And the answer is the original vote count when P&G declared victory, that was their estimate based on how many proxies they had received, how many shares there were outstanding, and how many shares they were told weren't voting. So it was an estimate. They said it was preliminary at the time, but nobody really knew until all of the votes were counted, because the way a proxy contest works is – you know, in this case, there was a white proxy that Peltz was asking people to send in. There was a blue proxy that P&G was asking people to send in. And neither side was able to know, you know, how many blue – like if you're on Proctor's side, you don't know how many proxies Peltz collected, and vice versa. Peltz didn't know how many proxies P&G collected. So both of them were guessing essentially based on what they knew. Their proxy solicitors had told them, we've gotten this many proxies back for this many shares. And usually you can make a pretty good guess, but when the margin of victory is less than 0.06% or 0.0006% yeah, right. It's, there's not much margin for error.
Dan, is that a usual thing where you have two different proxies out there, two different color proxies out there that represent two different things? Does that happen very often?
Proxy contests are not that uncommon. What's uncommon is the how close the race is. So you almost never see a reversal in a recount because they're never this close. So,
is Procter & Gamble conceding anything at this point?
No. They say they will honor the will of the shareholders once they're convinced that every vote has been counted and every vote was counted accurately. So,
how long will it take before you get a definite answer on this?
They're saying 3 to 4 weeks at least, because
3 to 4 weeks.
I mean, the process involves looking at in some cases every paper ballot to make sure if it's a jointly owned stock, did the spouse and the husband and wife, did they both sign the document? Otherwise, you can challenge it as, invalid. Or another thing that happens in proxy contests is, let's say somebody decided early on they wanted to favor Procter & Gamble, but then Peltz's argument started to make sense to them, so they sent in the white proxy. Well, by rule, it's the later proxy that counts as your vote. So it is possible that somebody sent in a proxy favoring Procter & Gamble, and then later sent in one favoring Peltz, and the Peltz votes wasn't counted. And you know, the opposite of that is true as well.
I wouldn't want to have the job of having to count the proxies. That's all I can say. So even if 3 to 4 weeks from now, Procter & Gamble comes back and says, well, you know what? They were right. He did win by about 43,000 votes.
Yeah.
Peltz is 75 at this point. Mm-hmm. Does P&G have any age restrictions for its board members?
Yes, they do. And they require their directors to retire at the age of 72. And this was an issue that was raised during the campaign. And in his proxy statements, Peltz said that he doesn't think that rule is binding. In other words, he thinks he still can serve, even though he's higher than the age limit. But if he can't, if Procter & Gamble's board says, no, we're not going to waive that rule, he nominated Edward Garden to be his replacement. And those
but
were
even
all,
Edward has some obstacles here, doesn't he?
Yeah, that's right. And this developed after the vote, because Garden recently was added to the GE board. He's already on two other boards, and Procter has a rule that you can't be on more than three boards. So if Garden were to join Procter & Gamble, he'd either have to leave one of the three boards he's serving on, or P&G would have to give him a waiver.
What was the argument that Peltz was making as to why he wanted to be on Procter & Gamble's board? What was he saying he wanted to do should he get on?
Well, he doesn't think P&G is running its business properly. He thinks there's too much bureaucracy, too many layers of decision-making. He doesn't think they're responding quickly enough to these sort of upstart rivals who are stealing market share from some of their established brands. He doesn't think... He thinks they have too much of a focus on big brands, Tide, Pampers, Gillette, and they should be focusing on developing the new brands that'll be the big brands of tomorrow. And finally, he doesn't like the corporate structure. He thinks it's too friendly to the top executives. He wants more control by the business unit managers to decide things like their marketing plan and their sales structure and whether or not they buy a smaller brand that looks like it's promising, or, what markets they enter, what markets they exit. He thinks it's too centralized now, and he wants the people who are in charge of actually growing the individual business lines, he wants them to have more control, more say over how the business operates.
So he thinks there's room for growth in it, and what is really a mature company. There's still room to get some more growth out of it.
He does. He thinks they've missed a lot of opportunities, and their big brands in a lot of cases are losing market share. Now, P&G argues that it is gaining market share or holding market share in most of the categories where it operates. It says that, they're divided into 10 business units, and they say that, the leaders of those business units do have operating control. And they also say that they have a plan that is working in key areas. But what happened after the election, after the annual meeting in October, was that P&G reported first quarter earnings, and they had sales growth of only 1% in organic sales, which excludes acquisitions and divestitures and all kinds of unusual events. And they had been promising analysts 2% to 3% growth in organic sales for the calendar year. Now, they're still saying they're going to get there, but when you start the quarter at 1% and you have to end the year at 3%, that raises doubts in the minds of people who are already critical of the company.
And tell me a little bit more about Peltz's company, Trian. What kind of they're a fund?
They're a hedge fund, and their strategy is to take big positions in companies and then push for change. What they look for are companies that are not performing up to par or that could be improved with better business strategies. And then they buy a big chunk of shares, and they either threaten a proxy fight like they did with P&G, or they negotiate their way onto the board. In the case of GE, I think they had like a $2 billion stake, and they started meeting with management, and management was receptive to a lot of their ideas. In fact, a lot of the cuts that GE just announced sort of were an outgrowth of that process. GE agreed to accelerate the restructuring of the company. They're looking to sell.
They're also trimming down and only holding some of their businesses.
Yeah, I think they said they were going to sell $20 billion in assets. And so that's an example of where Trian Partners took a big stake in a company, offered some new ideas, and the board of that company said, yeah, we like your ideas. And since then, you've seen, Jeffrey Immelt has left, a couple of other top managers have left the company, and the board has welcomed Ed Garden as a director, and GE has announced a massive restructuring.
So what, in terms of what this means for Procter & Gamble, mm-hmm. if he should make the board, what happens? What does that mean?
It probably means very little in the short term. And longer term, it means they're going to face more pressure from investors to ramp up the growth. They say they have a strategy that is starting to work. And if given more time, people will see faster growth. If Peltz is on the – it's easier for him to influence things if he's on the inside. So not only can he try to talk other board members into accepting his point of view, but he has access to proprietary information that he can't get right now. As a board member, he would have more financial information and more internal operating knowledge than he currently has. And so both of those things, I think, would be an advantage for him in terms of making arguments for changes in direction. And, it all really depends on how well Peltz can act to convince other board members that he has the right way of thinking. He'd be one of 12 votes.
That's what I was going to say. How much influence could he have as one of 12? So
none. If all he does is argue and they reject his ideas, it's 11-1 against him. But once he's on the board, in theory, he'd have better access to more information, and in theory, he could sort of use that position to lobby for change within the company.
So that's what it means for Procter & Gamble. Procter & Gamble is with its corporate headquarters here in Cincinnati, is a huge employer for the city.
Right.
What would his presence mean for Cincinnati?
Again, for the short term, very little.
Very little, okay.
Yeah, it's possible that the changes he's recommending could lead to a breakup of the company. I mean, that's one thing P&G argued during the campaign. He wants to realign the company into three big operating units with a holding company above that's very lean. And the three operating units would basically run as standalone properties, and they would buy services that P&G now provides to all brands under their conglomerate sort of configuration. So, if Peltz were to get his way and P&G divided into these three operating units, those would be three units where investors could see which one is growing, what their profitability is. And it might lead to offers from rivals to buy that company. Or it could lead to a strategy where P&G says, we think we can get a better shareholder. We can get a better return for shareholder if we spin off our laundry business into a freestanding company. And then everybody who owns Procter shares now would get a stake in that company. So, it is possible that if you follow the logical conclusion of what he's advocating, it is possible that someday P&G could break apart into smaller companies, and who knows where they'd be based.
But early on, you don't expect to see anything in the first few years if this should have come through.
I don't expect that kind of change very quickly.
And even if for some reason they look at this again and say, "No, wait a minute, he didn't win after all."
Mm-hmm.
He's not going away for any time, I take it.
No, he's not. As a matter of fact, in the most recent quarter, the hedge funds have to report quarterly how much stock they own, and he increased his P&G position after he was rejected by P&G at the annual meeting. The stock price went down, and he may have used that as an opportunity to buy more P&G stock. So he's actually increased his position. He indicated at the time of the annual meeting that he wasn't going away. And, some people thought that he might be back next year with another proxy proposal. So, he's going to increase the pressure. And win or lose, he had 1 billion shares voting his way. And that means P&G has to pay attention to that.
Dan, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
WCPO.com business reporter Dan Monk.